Hey everyone, welcome to the latest episode of If You've Come This Far, where my friend Chris and I have authentic conversations, because that's what we were just saying, right? We get to have authentic, that's what distinguishes us. Our conversations are authentic, and as we were saying, we get to talk to really smart people, so not that our questions are dumb, but you know, I think we do our best to just be, hey, we're just regular humans asking some questions.
Yeah, we're just trying to keep up, you know?
Right, just trying to keep up. And so I think we kept up all right with Alex, but he's an amazing dude. So why don't you tell folks about Alex Johnston?
Yeah, Alex Johnston. I was introduced to Alex by a former If You've Come This Far guest, Becky Crow, who is a good friend of mine. In fact, I don't remember if Becky introduced Alex and me to one another, but she sent me his book. So he wrote this book called Money with Meaning. He is in the business of philanthropy advising. He started a shop called Building Impact Partners. So he advises a lot of high net worth individuals on, you know, how and where to give their money away. And, you know, it's interesting, Sean, is that when we were talking about our conversation, I had a lot of technical questions that I wanted to get to, but I'm more interested in how he grew up, how he got there, yeah, how he thinks sort of philosophically about the work that he does, and right, how he connects with people. And then about his own journey of sort of continuous self-improvement. So
yeah. Well, thank God you didn't have time to ask technical questions. I mean, I mean the book, Money with Meaning, How to Create Joy and Impact. I mean, so the fact that we got into a lot of the joy stuff, I think is really good. And, you know, the other thing I want to say is that he has a philanthropy advising business, but I'm going to say it's kind of sneaky. He's advising ultra wealthy people about how to make their money have meaning, let's say. Mm-hmm. But in his head, he's having an impact on the world by getting these people in the game. I'm suggesting he has a whole plan for how to make really significant change by impacting these people in a way that is pretty special.
Well, it's an interesting point. In a few days or in 2 days, we're going to interview my friend Trish Tierney, who runs a shop called Wake, where she enlists volunteer women in the sort of middle upper management of a lot of tech firms to go to places, third world countries, to help women there. And you and I have talked about this before, but there is the direct impact that happens on the ground, say in Rwanda or Lithuania. Mm-hmm. But then there's this other impact that on the people that volunteer. And I think, like, to your point, I think what I'm understanding you is saying is, like, Alex sees the whole picture there.
Yes. Right.
And that's exactly what he's going for. But yeah, I mean, like, crazy smart dude.
Yeah. Crazy smart. I mean, focused on love and joy, grateful for his life and,
Lovely.
Lovely.
And you actually use these words, right? Like, because he talks a lot about, and other people do too, about getting all of this wealth off the sidelines. Mm-hmm. And my thought was the same as yours. It's like, okay, that implies that we want to get that money into the game.
Right.
And so how do you define the game right now? And it's probably individual. It probably changes over time. And it's so broad anyway, right?
Right. Yeah.
So it's an impossible question to answer. And when I dreamt it up last night, I was also looking forward to this conversation. I was like, is this a pithy question or is it a corny question?
I don't think it's corny at all. And I think, you know, one of the takeaways from the book is where does it kind of give you the most joy? And so not ego wise, I mean, like he gets into that, but it's like, okay, as an individual, you know, what's important to you and where do you get joy for that? And not the guilt about like effective altruism where it's like, okay, this is the equation. And so this is what you should do. It's like, I get it, but no, that's not moving me. Yep. I think folks are really going to enjoy this conversation.
All right, then, on with the show. Alex, meet my partner, Sean Alex.
Alex, nice to
on.
meet you.
I was checking out what you guys are doing, and really cool. I was just part of a meeting earlier this week, or was it last week? Dads for All, which is kind of a spin out of a organizing group, Dads for Kamala, but is now trying to broaden. And we were just talking about how there are just few spaces for guys to get together in a way that's generative. Also, like particularly wearing a dad identity.
How many guys are participating in that, Alex?
Well, it was a dinner that had a, there were about 18 or 19 folks just in that room. And I often think in units of like 6 to 8, because I feel like that's a great group size. I'm an EO and my forum, has 7 people in it. And a lot of the programming that we do for social entrepreneurs, we group people into what we call mastermind groups, where it's like 6 to 8 of them, and they're in kind of best 5%, worst 5%. Every month they're coming together to talk about that and then do a deep dive with one of them. And it's magic. And I to see just what you guys are doing online, like bringing everyone in, but then also doing small group stuff, it's just amazing.
Thanks. We're in our 7th year. We've seen, just amazing stuff. I mean, men from all over the world coming together, just very simply, just to have a conversation. It doesn't need to get any more complicated than that, really. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and
Yeah,
just
Alex,
funnily,
make sure your clients know about Men Living too, all right?
yeah, I'm I well, now that I know about it, I'm going to be talking about it more. And for years had family that lived in Elmhurst, and I saw that there's like actually a local group there. I totally would have recommended that to my brother-in-law, but now they relocated outside of St. Louis. So
So speak, the fact that we're like a man, we're focused on guys. I mean, I know you have 3 boys. How old are your boys, and
Fourteen,
how are they
twelve, and
doing?
ten, and we were talking about this with Dads for All. Like, what a challenging world it is to be raising boys right now. I mean, everybody's got challenges, but the sort of message they're getting from the manosphere is just so problematic.
I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, and I had no intention of doing this, but have you
But you're
guys?
gonna.
Well, I'm gonna. Yeah, I'm gonna. Have you guys watched this TV series, Adolescence?
No, we were talking about it at the dinner. I've read reviews of it. I don't want to watch it, honestly.
It's hard to watch, but it's also, it's also it highlights a real problem, kind of one that we're skirting around right now, right? It's we do have to get to these boys. Sean and I were talking about this on Sunday. That show made me think about what more can we do for young boys and young men as they get sort of spoon-fed this some of these awful messages.
Well, maybe this will be a theme of our conversation. I don't know, but I think a lot about my own childhood, and I think about this also in the context of the work I do in philanthropy, where I'm advising people who are far along in a journey to wealth, and very often their own circumstances are radically different now in their family context than they were growing up. And many of us, have traveled a similar journey, perhaps not to the same degree. But I know for me, growing up, my dad left when I was in 7th grade. And, we weren't uncomfortable in any way, but we did not have extras. And my kids are, growing up in Manhattan and just in a radically different context than what I grew up in, where, it's easy to bemoan this, right? But like, I grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, on a street that was right next to UMass, like the most densely populated square quarter mile in the world, I think at one time was the Southwest Dormitory Complex. And so I was right next to that, but it was a street that had like, a car came down at every 20 minutes, right? We could play tennis in the street. We jousted, on bikes with broken off hockey sticks and trash can lids and like just crazy stuff that. So that's maybe the wild side of it. But the other side of it was so many adults that I wasn't related to had a caring connection with me or placed responsibility on me. Like I went to an elementary school that did fundraising folk concerts, of course, because it was the 70s and early 80s. Right? And I was 9 years old, and they would have me working the door, like collecting the money and then bringing home the cash box counting the cash and bringing it back to school the next day on my bike. And I'm like 10 years old. That level of responsibility, handling like $1,200, you know, when I'm 10 years old, and knowing that my teachers trusted me to do that, like what that does for you psychologically is really significant. And I really feel like the context in which I know my boys are growing up, I really wish there were more opportunities. You know, we're members of a church, we're doing a lot of different things, but like that context just isn't around in my world the way that it was growing up. And it was hugely formative for me. And that's a problem, I think.
Yeah. I was on a call yesterday with a woman who's interested in getting involved with NAMI Chicago, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'm on the board of that organization. I think it's the second biggest chapter in the country. And she became interested because she has an adult son who has struggled with mental illness. And the thing that really struck me, and it's not like I didn't know this before, but it only really sort of hit me, is that she talked about how her son will go to his room and he'll be up until 1 in the morning, you know, with the door locked and the lights are still on or whatever. At least when we grew up, that was a safe space. Like that, we couldn't
you're
be
reading
exposed.
A book if you're
yeah,
doing
you're
that,
reading a right? book, like, right? And maybe it was a bad book, but you know, I mean, but these days, like there's no respite from the manosphere or from whatever messaging you're getting. And it feeds into politics too, but it's a tough time. We talk a lot about, you know, we're sort of loosely affiliated with our friend in Elmhurst, Todd Adams, who started Men Living. He and his wife do a thing called Zen Parenting Radio. And so Kathy we just published that episode actually, or we're going to, but she's a social worker and she coaches on parenting. Sure. And we talk a lot about, you know, how hard parenting is, and it's not getting any easier. That's for sure.
Yeah. And Elmhurst is like, in many ways, you know, you would think, I mean, I had in-laws who lived there for years. I used to spend a couple weeks a year in Elmhurst. And it's not like you'd look at that community and think, wow, that's a really tough place to raise kids. Quite the opposite.
Yeah. So you didn't think, oh, I'm going to be a Minuteman someday? You weren't going to, you know, I mean.
You're talking to another Bostonian here, Alex.
No, yeah, I saw that in your background. No, yeah. I did not. My dad was a professor at UMass. And,
okay.
I just knew I did not want to stay in Amherst.
Yeah.
But I did end up, you know, I went, you know, 90 miles east for college.
Yeah.
So it was still a 2-hour Peter Pan bus ride away.
Yeah.
Alex, are you okay if we drill down a little bit into your background? You mentioned that your dad left. I'm curious if you have siblings and how you're again, this was not, we don't have a script. So to say that this was not part of the script is an understatement, but how was your childhood and upbringing and hockey in the streets and everything else?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the question, and it's something that, you know, I'm 52 years old now. I think we carry the way we grew up with us and, you know, both the wounds and the blessings of that. Mm-hmm. And so big picture, I wouldn't change, you know, like I wouldn't change sort of my path, because it led me here. And I feel like I've reached a point of much more flourishing in this stage of my life. But, you know, to be sort of reflect back on my childhood growing up in Amherst, a college town. My dad was a university professor. My mom was the head of the social studies department in the junior high and then the high school there. And there were a lot of great things about growing up in that way and in my family. And, you know, I went to an independent elementary school called the Common School, which was not a Montessori school, but actually started in the basement of the church that we went to, Grace Church on the Common in Amherst, and not religiously affiliated, but it was a kind of small school where there were, you know, 10, 11, 12 kids in each grade, and you called teachers by their first names. There was a lot of like guitar and folk singing every Friday. And it was a co-op in a lot of ways in that it was run on a shoestring. And so families, you know, came in to clean the school, you know, big sort of outdoor cleanup events, just such a community around that school. So it was like a village in a way. And that I think was a really important part of kind of shaping my perspective, because it was also a very child-centered place. And, you know, my mom as an educator really sought that out.
Did you have brothers that
yeah,
you
so
either beat
I have
up
an
or
older brother,
got beat up by?
19 months older than me. He now lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and we have some great ways of connecting now later in life. You know, we go see a football game every year in Nashville. The Titans are a hard team to root for, but we do it anyways. And you know, we talk every couple of weeks as well, very regularly on Tuesday evenings. And I just really value that connection with him. There was a period of time when we were not connected, you know, nearly as closely. And I think growing up, you know, I think about this a lot with my own boys, the tendency to have rivalry. He's only 19 months older than me, and everything that he did, I did. You know, he joined the track team, I joined the track team, you know, like I was just right, kind of right behind him. And we also had very different responses or experiences with my parents' divorce. And I think for me, my adjustment was like achieve some sense of security through achievement, and like my way of trying to control things that felt out of my control was to buckle down. And he did very well in high school. But I think he experienced a more immediate sense of rejection in a way through that experience. Mm-hmm. I sublimated it. I was like, I'm dealing with that later. I'm not going to grapple with that. And so, you know, I had my therapy later, you know, and he was working that through much more actively in school. And, you know, I think some of what I've been led to do later in life was really realizing that the adjustment that I had, which was very functional in a way, you know, I ended up as valedictorian, went to an Ivy League school, got a Rhodes Scholarship. Like I did all those things, but I was not a happy camper. I wasn't like, there was not a lot of joy in my life. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to live that way in the long run. And I had to go on a journey to figure out, you know, how can I actually achieve impact in a way, like not achieve for the sake of what other people think of me, but how can I produce positive impact in the world and be filled with joy? Mm-hmm. And I love the premise of this show and the mission you guys are on. And, you know, it's so funny, like when you start paying attention to stuff, you start seeing it independently, right? But you guys mm-hmm. have arrived at this question of like fulfillment and impact. And I've been on a journey and literally started a program called the Joyful Impact Accelerator. And that premise of like bringing the joy into the work of social change, all of us who have a calling to make the world a better place, like we can drive at that with kind of a fear-based, control-oriented way of being, or we can rewire ourselves in a way. And so that was the work that I took on in my mid-40s. And it was kind of amazing to me in a way that like I had gone all that distance and not had a chance to really dig deep on wisdom that's, you know, thousands of years old about human flourishing that converges with what we're seeing on the cutting edge of modern research now. And it's just crazy to me that we haven't found a way to convey that more fully in different ways across our society. And of course, many societies actually do a much better job at this than we do in kind of modern market-based, particularly Western economies.
It's funny. I was going to come to your defense and say, well, you had other things going on. You were parenting, but your oldest, you said, is 14. So yeah. You didn't have him until you were, what, 38, right? Yeah. So Sean and I had talked about this before. I've heard you talk on at least one podcast, I think, about maybe a midlife crisis. You might have used that term. I don't remember.
I don't think of it as a crisis, more like a midlife moment, you know, because it wasn't
that's
like
what it sounds
something
like.
Was disastrous. It was just like, you know what? I don't want to be falling asleep at 5 o'clock on the couch because mm-hmm. I'm getting 4.5 hours of sleep a night.
Yeah.
And I want more positive presence with my family and honestly with my work, because I felt like, you know, and maybe this was just my sort of looking back on my life, but I had achieved a level of success early in life when the rules were really clear. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know what? I don't think I'm delivering as much positive impact in the world as I could be. And I have to find a way to do that. Like there's no, it's not like you can you know, again, high school and college, if you follow that conventional path, it's super clear, you know, like what the markers are. And it's just not that way, especially if you choose to be in a career where, you know, you're not climbing the ranks of a hierarchy, you know, in business, for example, or for in my case, in government.
Well, most people, I mean, when I saw it, when I got the book and I saw it, and I'm like, okay, money with meaning. I always screw up saying meaning with money. Money with meaning, how to create joy. So I'm like, wait, Chris, this guy's talking about joy and money. A lot of people, Alex, can't even talk, don't even know how to talk about joy. It feels, I think, at times, you know, in our society, as you said, not the right focus. And so that moment when you decided to embrace joy, how did you go about it? How did you go about making that transformation? And to me, when I, you know, read the book and listen to you talk and see the website, joy is at the center. So how did you make that transition? And what did you do to get there?
Appreciate the question. I think the start of my personal development journey, I really date it to around February of 2017. To be
well, that's pretty specific.
Yeah. And I really credit my good friend, Tim Taylor, who runs an organization called America Succeeds. And back in 2016, he and I were having a conversation. He was telling me about this organization called EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization. And he knew that, you know, we were 5-6 years into what then was called Impact for Education, the philanthropy advising firm that I founded. And I was in the process of kind of reconstituting the firm as a partnership, bringing partners in. And so my precipitating factor to join EO was I needed a group of peers who were kind of entrepreneurs who were navigating, like I was literally like trying to figure out, so an operating agreement and a partnership, and I had no frame of reference for this. I was an accidental entrepreneur. I got into philanthropy advising because I wanted to do my art, if you will, and you know, help donors direct resources where they could make the biggest difference. But turned out, you know, I couldn't kind of help myself. Danielle Allen, who I came into the firm and became our managing partner, you know, had a big role in kind of helping me shape this into a firm. And so I was committed to creating a firm. So I joined EO. But what happened when I joined EO was that I realized, oh, there's this other, I actually was, there was a guy who came to speak to the Connecticut chapter of EO, and he was a very successful entrepreneur. And he asked a room of 45 entrepreneurs, how many of you have a life mission statement? And one person raised their hand, and it wasn't me. And I'm like, huh. And then he said, you know, I have a very simple way of sort of coming at the world each day. It's my 10-10-10 plan. I spend 10 minutes you know, reflecting in gratitude every morning. I spend 10 minutes reading something positive, and I spend 10 minutes journaling and not pouring out my deep angst, but really reflecting on what's positive. And this is the kind of thing that while I'm not writing it for other people, my grandkids could read my journal and later on understand me better as a man. And I'm like, okay, tomorrow morning it's on. I'm going to try this out. And so that literally the next morning after that talk is when I started on this whole path. And, you know, I've tried so many different things. I ended up kind of going down a rabbit hole, reading hundreds of books on personal development. I think what that sort of activated in me was a kind of intensity, but applied in a positive way. Because I used to, back in the day when I, you know, did well in high school and college, I would apply that energy on taking notes on my notes and just like mastering, you know, and like creating control or the illusion of control that way. But I was able to sort of like take that kind of energy and apply it in a curious and experimental way instead of a kind of trying to sort of willpower my way. And so it wasn't like I was making myself do this. I just wanted to, but I could summon up that kind of focus. And so I really went deep and very quickly started to experience tremendous benefits from, you know, a daily gratitude practice and all kinds of stuff. Also an EO, a friend of mine in my forum was like, hey, you got to come to Unleash the Power Within. Tony Robbins, like intensive. I'm like, Tony Robbins, are you kidding? This is the guy that I remember growing up, like selling, like he was on late night TV, like right next to the guys who were selling timeshares and stuff.
Sure.
And I'm like, this guy is not real. But I was curious. So I started reading his stuff and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This is actually really thoughtful stuff. And I'm like, okay, I'll go. And I did. I went with my friend Mike, and we spent 4 days, in the basically the civic center in Newark, with 14,000 people, walked across a bed of coals, all of that. And that also really activated me. And I'm like, I could see him helping people in a transformational way in front of me in this, and it wasn't fake. And I'm like, I really want to understand how he does that. And so I went through his coach training program, and then I trained in like three other coaching modalities. And before you know it, I was just sort of putting off an energy that some of the clients I was working with were like, "What's going on with you?" And some of them got curious. And so I started coaching some of the clients that I was advising, ultra high net worth folks in philanthropy. And that then created an opening to really be thinking about the intersection of joy and impact. And some of those donors had this thought of like, "Hey, it's been really powerful for me and for you to, experience kind of access to all this stuff on human flourishing. How could we create a space where the people who are leading the organizations we're supporting can benefit from that?" And one-on-one coaching really doesn't scale very well. But we created a cohort-based program that included one-on-one coaching, along with mastermind groups where people are coming together in total confidentiality to share the best 5%, the worst 5%, the joy, and the defeat. And then I built a whole curriculum over time, seven pillars of personal development, and that really centers joy as sort of like replacing your energy source. So moving from fear to joy as your energy source. So I could go on and on on this, but
No, I love this. Wait,
there's a deeper way
I
there.
want to circle back. Are you saying that in that time period, 2016, 2017, your colleagues and your peers and your friends and maybe your partner were seeing your light like brighten?
Yeah, I mean, I think that before I sort of started on this journey, I don't know that people who weren't close to me would have thought would have seen something wrong. Because I was still showing up in a successful way outwardly, but I internally did not feel joy. I felt exhaustion. I felt, just sadness, anger, confusion, all of these things like that I now think of as obstructing angels. That like my immune system, my psychological immune system, like Lisa Leahy and Bob Keegan have a great book, Immunity to Change, which has been
Yeah,
hugely
sure.
important for me. And I think that I was really blocked from advancing in important ways. So certainly my family could see that the quality of my presence was not high if I literally was like falling asleep, at 5 o'clock, at the end of the day. I'm just like, I just lay down on the couch and then I'm out. Like that's not how I want to show up. But before I got my Oura Ring, I was getting 4.5 hours of actual sleep per night. And I now get close to 7 hours of actual sleep per night. And that alone, right? That was a long process of experimentation, taping my mouth shut, all kinds of stuff but I think it is true that once I started on this journey, how I showed up did start to change. And that people, like particularly some of the clients that I worked with, picked up on that because we were already in a human to human relationship, right? And so when that's the case, if you come across something that's amazing, it manifests in various ways.
Just want to say before we leave this, I just want to say that I often talk about, particularly in Men Living, that I try to live at a baseline of joy, and that I know, and you have in the book, you talk about the various things that, as an individual, as a human, we should do. Sleep, you talk about mindfulness, you talk about, but through meditation and mindfulness, know when that baseline is off. And it's like, okay, what's happening in my life right now? Did I not get enough sleep? Or my Lisa and I in a conflict, something happened with one of my kids. I mean, what is the thing that is affecting that baseline of joy? Because when it's a baseline and you wake up in the morning, you're like, it's on, it's joy. I mean, it's just life is a different place. Now, I agree with you completely. And again, you talk about it in the book. Fear is what you're, it's all about fear. It's like, what am I afraid of in each one of those instances? What is wrong with me? And how do I let go of that fear to find that joy? And I don't want to, I don't want to say it's easy, but I also want to say I don't think it's hard. When you make a decision to do that, for that to be the baseline, then you're making that call, and you just follow you just follow that process, I guess. I don't know. How do you react to that?
I agree. I don't think that change itself is difficult. But what, in my experience, what I've come to see, and now having coached at this point, you know, hundreds of folks, the biggest challenge is getting ready for change. And I think there are a couple of preconditions that we have to go through before we're ready. We have to become awake to our own discomfort and our own pain.
Yeah.
We have to become aware of the system that helps to stop us from experiencing joy. And we then need to become accepting of our own agency in that process, that we actually have responsibility for how we feel, how we think, and how we act. And our world is increasingly set up to put us to sleep. So that very first stage of awakening is actually, there are massive industries now that are devoted to distracting us and numbing us out, or sort of super stimulating us so that we're not even in touch. And, you know, of course, people in 12-step programs have known for decades, right, that not experiencing your feelings, you know, we medicate ourselves in order to not experience them. But there are so many other strategies that seem more benign, but that have the same impact of not experiencing life. And it's scary to confront your feelings. It's not easy, and that's what blocks people from change.
And you talked about earlier, you talked about, you know, I think you said something about stop living for other people. I think that's a big part of it too, is we, at some level, it's about the other person and how they're making me feel. And it's not about the other person. It's like, how are we interacting such that what you're doing and what you're saying, I'm taking it badly, but that's all on me. It's not on you. The blame is, you know, it's just another way of not accepting, you know, who we are and what we're dealing with, I think.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that, you know,
there's a lot of that.
It's God's joke or whatever you believe in the universe, like that we are, through evolutionary biology, we are wired for a fight, flight, or freeze world that no longer exists. Mm-hmm. And so our cell phones can put us, you know, in fear of our lives, in effect, as far as our nervous system is concerned. And, you know, that's just, that's no fun.
Hey, listeners, I started testing this app called Mental in late 2024, and I've used it literally every day since. Mental is designed specifically for men's mental health, and I can honestly say that I've felt the impact. Handling stress better, building resilience, and feeling stronger, really both physically and mentally. So every day I take a cold shower and I knock out a round of push-ups with coaching from a retired Navy SEAL and a former world heavyweight boxing champion. And while I was skeptical at first, probably even more skeptical than I was about cold showers, I've also been using Mental's AI therapy function. It's not meant to replace real life therapy, but I have found it to be surprisingly valuable. What sets Mental apart is that it's not based on pseudoscience or bro science. It was developed by PhDs in neuroscience and counseling psychology. So it's real science designed to make a real impact. So if you're looking for a way to strengthen your mind and body, I highly recommend giving Mental a try. You can download it using the link in our show notes and get 20% off your annual subscription. I really don't think you'll regret it.
I was grappling with this a couple months ago, and the awareness I had was that I don't think that I inflate my level of joy, but I do think that I discount all the things that disrupt that, right? I suppress them. I deny their existence. I press on. And maybe that's because we're, you know, three white men that grew up in the 70s, but and maybe we were conditioned to do that. But I want to go. We've talked a number of times already about this idea of human connection. And I refer to a lot of what Men Living does as peer support. And, you know, sometimes you need therapy, sometimes you need peer support, et cetera. Alex, you started building Impact Partners and you chose a business where you were going to connect with I think a lot of high net worth, ultra high net worth individuals. And I'm certainly not suggesting that those people aren't humans, but did you find that you, to connect with them, you needed to take a different approach? Were you immediately good at it? Had you done it before?
Well, I think my entry into philanthropy advising came, it's a fairly common path, actually, for people who are running nonprofits that end up building relationships with donors. And that is a bridge into philanthropy advising. So in my case, I was running an advocacy organization, and there were a number of ultra high net worth individuals who were involved in that organization. And so I had, over a period of years, gotten to know them and gotten to know them as human beings, not as, you know, I really don't like the term funder, right? Because funders, like, it makes it seem like anyone who gives you money is a funder. So maybe that's true in some narrow sense, but there's such a diversity of people and organizations who are providing support to others. And so I think it discourages us to view people as human beings when we talk mm-hmm. about funders. Mm-hmm. But I went into philanthropy advising because I was also at that time involved with the Policy Innovators and Education Network, PI Network. And when that organization became an independent nonprofit, I was chairing that board. And it gave me a window into dozens of advocacy organizations around the country, a number of whom did not have access to ultra high net worth individuals and their donor base. And so I got a chance, because I did in my organization, I could see what a difference it made and how when people do show up in their advocacy as human beings and they're willing to engage with other people, there's a lot of positive that can come from that. But there are also a lot of cautionary tales, and that can really go wrong. And so I became just very interested. You know, I've been, in many ways, I feel like my work has always been anchored in trying to make the world a better place, and particularly helping this country live up to promises that it has made but never honestly kept around issues of equity and access and opportunity. And so I started out in housing for 10 years, affordable housing, and I ended up as director of operations of a housing authority. Then I moved into education advocacy because I felt like I was still, you know, downstream of some of the real sources of inequality and inequity. And then I moved into philanthropy advising because I felt like that's another place where I can get closer to the kind of systemic impact that I'm really hoping to contribute to. And so I did know a bunch of individuals. And what I've just consistently found is, you know, and this is maybe a countercultural message in this moment, but ultra wealthy people, of course, are human beings, right? We sort of know that in a sense, but culturally, we have a couple of strategies where, you know, we're looking at this concentration of wealth that's been steadily concentrating at least since 1981. There's data from the Fed that shows it super clearly from 1989 to the present. And literally what's been happening is the top 1% in terms of wealth, their wealth has grown at the expense of literally every other group. When you look at the chart, literally everyone else's piece is getting smaller and theirs is getting bigger. So it's very easy for most people to look at that and feel resentful. And to have a lot of narratives that they're putting on to who those people must be and what their lives are like and what they think and everything else. And what I have actually experienced, well, there's a couple of things. One is that people who create wealth above 30 million, which is defined as ultra high net worth, almost 75% of them are first generation wealth creators. Mm-hmm. And most of them are entrepreneurs or people who have kind of built something that, you know, ended up being worth a lot of money. So they have not entirely, but like less than 7%, 6.4% of ultra wealthy people got that way because they inherited all their money. Mm-hmm. And that is not what we understand in this country. Mm-hmm. We think about dynastic wealth. We think that there isn't churn at that top level. And for sure, there are massive problems with social mobility. But when we're talking about that very top group, there is actually a lot of churn there, and it's very hard for them to pass their resources on across the generations because many of them have no template for parenting as an ultra wealthy person because they grew up in a middle class or even a working class scenario. And they approach their philanthropy bringing that same ethos with them, which is both a blessing and a curse, because even if they have billions of dollars now, $1 million is still in their head an anchoring ton of money. And you got to like really be careful if you're going to like give away $1 million. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, and I could keep going with statistics, but it's crazy. Like only like less than 20 people on the Forbes list have given, I think it's actually less than 10 on the Forbes 400 list have given away even 20% of their total net worth in their lifetimes. And most of them have given away like far less single digit percentages. So there is a lot of work to do. And like, and I really believe the answer is actually in helping people engage, not just by saying, hey, you should, we should shame you into giving more.
Right.
Or I don't, that's just not, it's literally not working. And the other strategy that we have in our society is we should change regulation and policy. Yeah. And I think we should, but let's look at our political system right now. Do we honestly believe that we're going to see bills pass Congress that, you know, require distributions from donor-advised funds? Those bills have already been stuck before this current administration, and I don't see any prospect of them moving now. And so if we, in a world on fire, want to get, want to help ultra-wealthy people give more, it's countercultural to say, but we actually have to help them want to give more.
I'm curious, just another stat that I've seen recently is I'm not going to get it right. You may know the stat that there's going to be a shift of like $1 trillion to women. Women are going to hold like wealth of like $1 trillion in the next decade or so. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, the families that they're in, maybe men are dying and they're also accumulating wealth themselves. You know that number. Do you think that is going to change things where so much of that wealth is in the hands of
women? Are you women, asking, Alex, actually? If women are smarter like Jerry Garcia said?
Oh, I already know that. I already know that. I don't have to ask.
Okay, good,
I already know that. I'm looking at more from the standpoint of giving just because I mean, women, females are more givers than men are. And so I'm just curious if that's something that you think is going to change.
Absolutely. And that statistic is even more amplified than what you suggested. I think the numbers that I've seen are that there's about $85 trillion that will be transferring wealth transfer coming.
Yeah.
And of that, about $9 trillion is going to move laterally from men to women, because women on average live longer. And if they're in a male-female relationship, they're going to hold wealth for an average of 4 years after their spouse passes away. So there is a big reason to pay attention to this.
Right.
And you know, this is really over the next 20 to 25 years, it's about $9 trillion that will shift horizontally. And then there's a bunch of rising gen individuals who are daughters who will be inheriting wealth. And I'm very happy to say this, there are more and more women who are rising to wealth as wealth creators themselves.
Right.
And what we see from the data is that women are twice as likely as men to be in the highest propensity donor group, meaning the people who give the most. And if every philanthropy advisor can tell you that when women are sole decision makers around philanthropy, that maybe not in every single instance, but they are showing up in some really different ways. Well, Mackenzie Scott is a very.
I was just going to say, you talk about her a lot in the book, and
yeah.
I mean, her example is, I mean, I would ask you, do you think she's the best example of strategic philanthropy or giving in a way that you think is a model for giving money away?
I think one of the things that I'm trying to convey in the book is that strategic philanthropy, as it's sort of commonly understood, is actually not the best answer for many donors. So in that conventional way of looking at strategic philanthropy, that's where the donor has an idea, a theory of change, and they develop metrics and milestones and a whole process for testing their theory and then getting feedback from grantees, making strategic adjustments. And the goal is that they're applying a very rigorous method to maximize the impact of their dollars over time. And that is a great way to go for, I think, a small number of grantees who are really committed to that rigor and who are very willing to spend a lot of time in proximity to people who are on the ground doing the work, you know, and to generate ideas from the field. But strategic philanthropy, as it's often practiced, is actually very removed from the communities that it seeks to serve, where the ideas may be just like, I came up with this and I'm going to do this because it's my strategy and it makes me feel different or it makes me feel good about myself in some way. And so what I think Mackenzie Scott has done, it's not that it's not strategic, but what she's really said is, I don't need to have the ideas.
Right.
I've got five issue areas that I care about. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do, in the book, we call it wings with no strings. I'm just going to give a huge amount of money to organizations that I think are already soaring high or are poised for takeoff. And then they do what they think makes sense with it. Yeah. I don't need to tell them. It's not a casting call. I don't need to fit them into my story. Mm-hmm. I just want to support them. So I think that is a tremendous model. And she's shown that, you know, hey, this is not that difficult. You can give away $20 billion in 3-4 years. And there, a study just came out from the Center on Effective Philanthropy, Phil Buchanan and others. And it has shown that by interviewing hundreds of those grantees, the transformative impact that it's had, and that it is not a perfect strategy. And if every donor operated that way, we'd have another set of issues. But as an inspiration to get money moving, I think it's a phenomenal example. But I'm not, I don't suggest that's the right approach for everybody.
Yeah,
it's been great to see her move so boldly and so quickly to get that much money out the door. Mm-hmm.
Alex, I think a takeaway for me from your book and from having talked to you before is the challenge to, let's call it, get money off the sidelines is partly one of identifying the intent, right? Or making people recognize their intent to want to give. And then there's the execution part, right? Like, okay, great. I want to give. I want to give to these causes. I want to give to these geographies, et cetera. I want to give in this way via this vehicle. But which is harder for you as an advisor? Is it getting people across the intent hurdle or is it the execution part?
Well, it's a great question. And I think the field of philanthropy advising conventionally starts when people have already formed intent. Because philanthropy advising isn't free. There's some great models actually that are making it free, like Climate Lead. And I think there's a real opportunity to help donors where they don't have to pay for philanthropy advising, but they can get support because it's sponsored by others. But setting that aside, most philanthropy advisors, by definition, are working with people who already have philanthropic intent. And so there's a lot that we do to help clarify intents and help connect people with giving opportunities that will be both socially impactful and, you know, personally relevant and fulfilling. But there's another body of work, which I'm also interested in and increasingly starting to work in, which is around how do we help ultra wealthy people who are not thinking about philanthropy in any significant way begin to develop their own relationship with their wealth such that they, in seeking their own flourishing, come to find that giving is a significant part of that. And so, you know, I think one of the real keys there is that there's an underwhelm of affluence, that lots of people who go on that journey to wealth arrive at in ultra wealthy status, but are not experiencing psychological joy, fulfillment, happiness, satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Yep. They don't feel a sense of abundance. They may be up at 3 a.m. checking their net worth, you know, things that other people would think like, what are you talking about? Like, you have it made. And yet, because that drive, you know, to strive and aspire and acquire is so powerful, and for the people who really break through into ultra wealth, almost all of them have really been like going at it hard, and it's really hard for them to switch gears. And in many cases, they have never reflected on what truly is enough, both in a financial sense, but in other areas of their lives. And so if you can't answer that question, you can't actually ever experience abundance.
So, Alex, what percentage of the folks over 30 million are giving or not giving? Or, I mean, you talk about getting them into a point where they can start to feel comfortable with that. What are we talking about? What's a percentage look like?
Well, overall, that group of people is in the U.S. now. There's about 165,000 people with 30 million or more. Collectively, they have at least 17 trillion in wealth. And I think the latest numbers, which aren't fully released yet, may take that number over 20 trillion. And as a group, they're giving away about 85 billion a year, which is about 0.5% of that total wealth. Now, that's actually, if you think about your personal philanthropy and your personal wealth, 0.5% per year is not a huge amount, but it's not nothing either.
Right.
And yet the distribution is remarkably uneven because there are some people in that group who are giving away literally billions of dollars a year,
right,
some of the billionaires. And right, there are other people who are literally giving away almost nothing.
Yeah.
And so there is a dramatic disparity. I don't, interestingly, I have not been able to find what I consider to be a really reliable data set about the percentage of giving in sort of different brackets, because I think it would take survey research that you'd need a response rate from this group. You need to get like a survey, a sample size of 400 to 500 people. And I haven't seen that yet. And it's actually something I'm interested in trying to
do. Pursue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But my intuition tells me that it may be 50% or more of that group are really not engaged in a significant way. And I think when you look at the Forbes list, we do have better data on the very wealthiest folks. And what we see there is that 3/4 of them have given away less than 5% of their total net worth in their lifetimes.
Mm. Yeah, that's the structure part of this. I feel like at some point, I worked more than 20 years ago for Morningstar, founded by Joe Mansueto, who was a Warren Buffett disciple. And I feel like we can't go this whole hour without talking about the Giving Pledge. But like, it's not hard to build a spreadsheet that says, look, if you're worth $30 million and you can return safely 5% on that or 4 or 5% on that, and then you go and you put 10% of that in a private foundation from which you have to distribute only 5%, of course your wealth is only going to grow. I mean, of course, the private foundation is set aside, but like, on the remaining $27 million, you're growing at 5%. That's not going to be the strategy to come through on your giving pledge that you signed with Warren Buffett. So is that kind of like, those are the structures you talked earlier about, policy and DAFs and everything else.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the policy structure that you're thinking, oh God, if you could wave a magic wand, that might be it?
Well, I do think there are important policy changes to make. Post-World War II, the top marginal tax rate for the wealthiest among us was 70 to 90%. Mm-hmm. And psychologically, you can understand. And people weren't complaining about that back then, because we had to rebuild the country. We had to repay debt from World War II. We needed to do things like the GI Bill. And we had a greater sense of togetherness as a country that allowed for people to kind of be in it together in that way. And we just have a very different sort of a view of taxes now as a society. And, you know, nobody ever likes to pay taxes, right? But I think part of the answer is that I don't believe that it's sustainable to create a society where gains are so incredibly concentrated. Mm-hmm. And we're because there are absolutely a lot of great research out there that, you know, humanity in many collective ways is flourishing like it never has before. We've had greater abundance than we've ever had before. And there's a lot of things you can look to that are extremely positive. But if we don't figure out how to distribute the gains of entrepreneurialism and productivity in a way that is more inclusive, I don't think we can sustain this. And Walter Scheidel, a historian, has a book called The Great Leveler, which looks at the history of inequality in every society going back thousands of years where we've got enough records to be able to judge wealth inequality over time. And what he sees is a wave pattern where in any given society, wealth will concentrate and then it deconcentrates and then it reconcentrates. And what is it at the peak of that concentration wave? What's the inflection point? Why does wealth deconcentrate? And he found a scary and super consistent answer, which is literally, there hasn't been an exception to this. At least this is what he claims in the book. It's the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It's mass mobilization warfare, state collapse, revolution, and plagues. Mm. That is what deconcentrates wealth. Mm. And if we in this country are approaching peak wealth inequality, rivaling, if not exceeding, what we saw in the Gilded Age, and we could look back at the time of slavery and we'd have to understand the numbers differently. And there's some important research there because we don't want to neglect the fact that historically we've had brutal inequality in various ways. But we can't think that it's okay and safe. And you know, when I think about my three boys and the world they're living in, I don't want them or anyone else's children to live through those four horsemen of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm, right. And I look out in this world right now and I see those horsemen riding the land, right? But And I think, and this is why I feel so passionately about the work that we're doing at Building Impact Partners and other firms like ours and everyone who's out there trying to help philanthropy play a more significant role. Because in the short run, we can't shame people into giving more. We're not going to succeed in changing policy in the short run to deconcentrate wealth. So one of the greatest opportunities is actually for ultra wealthy people to make an active choice that they want to see a society that operates on a different basis and to choose to invest some of their resources in what you might call philanthropy-assisted policy change to help bring about the conditions where prosperity is more broadly enjoyed. And that's not, I don't think we have to like adhere to a particular ideology. And we're not talking, I personally don't think we need to, you know, we don't necessarily have to tax wealth or outlaw billionaires or some of the ideas that are out there that ultra wealthy people sort of dismiss out of hand. We don't have to go to that extreme to actually for ultra wealthy people to make some different choices individually and ultimately collectively. And I think that the path to do that is, again, not shaming. It's that work one-on-one. And there's something called the Enough Project, which is founded by someone who was very successful in wealth management and started to ask himself the question, like, how much is enough? And to your point earlier, Chris, he actually built a spreadsheet, a thing you can use that say, if you're a successful entrepreneur and you just sold your company for $100 million and you're 55 years old, you can map out, you know, how much money you want to leave to your family, how much, you know, the different rates of return in different parts of your portfolio. And he did this himself. And what he realized was like, wow, actually, yeah, I do have enough to meet all of the needs I could conceivably have for myself. And right, then I have this awesome opportunity to give, to invest in the things that, and the people that I'm excited to support. And that he's a professional wealth manager. And he didn't have this realization until he really sat down and did the numbers. So I think there's a lot of block and tackling at the individual level that's needed to get there.
So I want to read this before I ask my question because it dovetails. So your vision on your website for Building Impact Partners, we envision a world in which resource engines distribute capital in all forms joyfully, efficiently, and equitably so that resources flow where they are most needed to create transformative impact on the issues that matter most to our shared future. You just went through vision stuff as far as I'm concerned and what you just talked about. Are you actively trying to get, I mean, sure, people are going to find you, people that want to give their money, we're going to find you and look for support from you. But are you actively working to get ultra wealthy people off the sidelines and in the game? I mean, are you recruiting? I mean, getting them, because, you know, not only are there societal benefits, we all know the data that's out there. We all don't know, but there's plenty of data out there that says the benefits that we get by giving, by being engaged in this are substantial. So is that what part of what you're doing is rallying people, getting them off the sidelines?
Yeah. So at Building Impact Partners, there are three components to our work. One is advising, which, you know, is what it sounds like. It's working with ultra wealthy institutions and individuals to help them on their giving. Those are, by definition, people who've already formed intent and are acting. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's a significant part of our work. Yep. Another part of our work that is more recent but is growing really significantly is what we call high impact grant making, where we're helping some of the country's highest capacity donors build outsourced infrastructure. So when they have a big idea, they can act on it and make it happen in the world. Because what we're seeing increasingly is that some of the biggest donors, unlike, say, the Gates Foundation, don't want to staff up. And so it becomes a limiting factor for them that they might have a big idea, but they really need a trusted partner and set of people who can help them make those things happen in the world. And so that's a big part of what we're doing. We partner with fiscal sponsors and others to move, you know, now a couple $100 million a year in that kind of way. Okay. And very often the donors are like, this is amazing. I did not know that you could sort of have that end-to-end support from, you know, idea all the way to execution. And that weirdly, I mean, I guess it isn't weird, but like that is a barrier, right? The absence of that means that money will sit on the sidelines. So one of the biggest opportunities to get money off the sidelines is to help people who've already signed the giving pledge, who are already in, actually just get the pipe bigger so the money can flow.
Well, what's weird though, Alex, is that I mean, you talked about the 75% of the people that have reached this status. They've built that themselves, often by building a business that generated that wealth. So they have some concept, I would think, about strategy and organization and how to go about executing that. But when it comes to this, are they just like, wait, I don't know how to do this?
Well, no, I think it's more that many of them are still actively involved in their own wealth creation.
These are not
people who retire. And so the bandwidth they have might be 5 hours a week. And having a really solid outsourced partner, I think part of this is the industry's falling short. You know, the shape of the philanthropy advising industry is a handful of market leading, very large firms, which do great work, and hundreds of solopreneurs, and then a few dozen boutique firms like Building Impact Partners. And what we're trying to do is define a new category in the marketplace where, because we have deep relationships with many of the solopreneurs, we can put together teams that have, you know, 40 people on them. And we can do it in a way that is rapid and responsive and grounded in people who really understand how to do the work. Mm-hmm. And that is a real difference maker. So that's the core of that second piece. But the third piece we're doing is field building. And that is where we're training philanthropy advisors in a program called Advisors Accelerator, where the Joyful Impact Accelerator for social entrepreneurs sits. We have a curriculum called Fully Human Fundraising, which is helping people who are raising resources show up instead of in a transactional, hey, I want to pitch you and get money. Let's actually, you know, engage as human beings. And that improves the experience for ultra wealthy people as well as those raising resources, which is critically important. And then we have another thing, which is just getting started around sort of elevating the perspective or experience that ultra wealthy people have with their wealth itself. And that doesn't involve starting out as like, hey, we want you to give more money. It's more like, how are you experiencing wealth? Are you flourishing? Where are you on Marty Seligman's perma scale of flourishing? And then connecting that back and testing, because we have a hypothesis that there's a best way of being wealthy, building wealth purposefully, enjoying wealth mindfully, sharing wealth meaningfully, and transforming wealth creatively. And that ultra wealthy people who do all of those things are in fact flourishing really disproportionately. There is a code, and it's right there in plain sight. When you look at the people who are really experiencing incredible fulfillment and making a huge difference in the world, but many, many, many ultra wealthy people are asymmetric across those four things. They've been super successful at building wealth, but they haven't defined the purpose of it, right? They haven't built their wealth purposefully. And when they come to enjoying wealth, they're either avoidant, they pretend they don't have it, they don't tell their kids, they're not showing it to the world, or they're overindulgent and they're not achieving that balance. So you think about men living, like it's the same stuff, right? It's just applied in a group of folks who don't have to, they can keep doing what they're doing. The world's not going to tell them they have a problem. Although when, you know, unfortunately, the United Health CEO gets shot in the back on the street and half the country cheers, we as a society have a big problem.
No doubt. Hey, fellas, I got bad news to break. The hour has flown by. Alex, do you have like 4 or 5 more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. I have more questions. But in light of the time, I think we have to get to our closing segment where we always ask our guests 3 questions that are sort of more meta. So if you're game, I'm going to fire those at you. The first question is, I feel this is so abrupt, this ending to this hour.
Bring it on.
Jesus. I apologize. Okay. The first question is, what do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self there in Amherst, Mass?
Well, my 10-year-old self is right here with me.
Hey.
Wow.
I've done some inner child work and what I would have told him is, you're going to be okay. It's going to be okay because he's with me today. He is my vigilant self. And I tell him frequently on a daily basis, like, I hear you, buddy. I feel that in my stomach and it's okay. And thank you.
That's
wonderful. And those haircuts were in back then.
They were. My kids can't believe it. Yeah. That's all right. It was literally a bowl on my head. My mom cutting a wrap.
Okay. Second question. That is funny. We all had that haircut, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
At least when we had hair. The second question is, do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
Yeah. Love, gratitude, presence, joy. Hmm.
Of course, you've got this pithy, you know.
I say that. I mean, I literally, those words are words I write down every time in my journal.
Are you still doing the 10-10-10 thing?
I modified it, but yes, I have a whole system I created for myself. So I have daily reflection questions, and I am a prolific reader, and I have several gratitude practices that I do every day. And if there's one thing that as a gateway into any of this, a gratitude practice, as simple as just putting your hands over your heart and reflecting for 5 seconds on something you're grateful for. To me, that was such a powerful gateway to that process of awakening. And because again, awakening to your pain is hard. And so anchoring yourself in feelings of gratitude is like the buffer that creates the space for me, at least. And when I first tried to meditate, I literally was petrified because the minute I tried to clear my mind, that 10-year-old self was like, just like all the anxiety was, it was super hard.
I just appreciate how much work you do on yourself. So I just want to take a moment to say that. And now I'll ask you the final question, which is, what do you hope that people will say about you at your wake?
Well, oddly, you know, I've had a couple of experiences, particularly with, say, the Joyful Impact Accelerator, where as we bring people together, you know, current cohort, 16 social entrepreneurs each year, and we gather, you know, sometimes we have 30, 40 of us together in person. And so I've actually had, you know, I just feel such gratitude for this. Sometimes people in a group have shared back with me how just their intersection with me has been a catalyst for powerful transformation in their own lives. And that's all that I can hope for. I think, you know, I think the meaning of life is actually remarkably simple. It's to grow yourself into the best version that you can be so as to be, you know, of service to others. And I don't think it's complicated. And so if any one of us has the privilege to hear how we've created a positive impact for others, it's an incredible gift. And so that's also something I try to pay forward. And when someone really positively impacts me, like I recently, through Nico Kanner, who runs the firm Incandescent, he connected me with Bob Keegan and Lisa Leahy, who wrote the book Immunity.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a chance to sit with him and say, here's my book, and it wouldn't exist if it weren't for your book. Wow. So thank you. And those are just remarkable moments.
That's awesome. Well, it seems like my appreciation for your self-work was poignant. You know, it's probably the first smart thing I said in a few episodes. So, Alex, thanks for joining us, man.
It's great.
Such a pleasure. I really appreciate the mission you're on here, to just have these authentic conversations and let people hear each other as human beings.
Yeah, that's the goal. Well,
it was a pleasure.
Yeah, we appreciate you, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks, Alex.
See ya.
Peace.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.